Buddhist Summer School, Sunday afternoon, 2nd September 1979. And friends, recall the words of the Arahat Kacchana the Great when talking about the Buddha. He calls him the giver of the deathless. What did the Buddha himself say? When he comes to the five who were his fellow ascetics previously, and meets them again, he announces unequivocally, "The Tathagata, O bhikkhus, is the Arahant, all enlightened. Hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been found. I teach, I make plain the truth. If you walk as I teach, you will ere long, and in the present life, learn fully for yourselves, realize, make real, that is, and having attained, abide in the supreme fulfillment of Brahma Farim, the living of the holy life, for the sake of which the clansmen rightly go forth from home into the homeless life. The deathless has been found." That deathless we can well associate with perfect wholeness, with holiness, with health, well-being, and with perfect happiness. I mention these only because they all touch our own personal lives very, very intimately. The Buddha was not at all insensitive to the needs of the multitude. He knew that they wanted happiness, what they would consider the greatest blessing. And in this Mahamangala Sutta, he declares what is the greatest blessing. I won't go through the whole category, but mention just one point, because it does touch millions of people, particularly today. To support father and mother, to cherish wife and child, to follow a peaceful calling, that is the greatest blessing. He was not exclusively concerned with his disciples, but with all mankind. Again, what does he say when he sends forth his bhikkhus to teach? to the first 60 perfected ones, he gives this mandate: walk bhikkhus on tour for the blessing of the many folk, the multitudes, for the happiness of the many folk, out of compassion for the world and for the welfare, for the blessing, the happiness of devas and men. And 40 years later, shortly before his death, he says at the Kutagara Hall, "Therefore, bhikkhus, ye to whom the truths I have perceived have been made known by me, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, practice them, meditate upon them, and spread them abroad, in order that pure religion may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of pity for the world, to the good and the gain and the weal of devas and men." One other quotation I would like to give. A Brahmin called Puttapada has a long discussion with him on various topics, and the Buddha gives him detailed answers. But he notices that in the mind of Puttapada there is perhaps a little doubt whether living the holy life does, amongst other things, lead to happiness, to joy. Now it may be, Puttapada, that you think evil dispositions may be put away, the dispositions that tend to purification may increase, one may continue to see face to face and by himself come to realize the full perfection and grandeur of wisdom. But one may continue sad. And the Buddha goes on. Now that, Puttapada, would not be accurate judgment. When such conditions are fulfilled, then there will be joy and happiness and peace, and in continual mindfulness and self-mastery one will dwell at ease. Now these are the affirmations and the assurance, the promise, which the Buddha himself gave to those who came to him. So we see that his concern was with every individual's own being, his psychophysical being, the existential person that we see in front of us in the world, as well as the multitudes. Now he spoke of deathlessness. that you will attain deathlessness here and now. But we all know that what we commonly call you, the existential person, dies. No one lives permanently. The holy ones themselves have, every one of them, died. And with that death, we have to associate the dissolution of all the component elements that make up that empirical being. So what did the Buddha mean by saying deathlessness is realized here and now? Remember, we are psychophysical beings. Generally speaking, the body which is born, the new infant, has a reasonable chance of being healthy, well, physically, growing to maturity, and then continuing physically for a few or many more years. Nature plays the biggest part in this aspect of his life history. But there is the psyche. Now, does the psyche ever come to maturity in the thousands of millions who live on the globe? Where does misery, suffering, joy, happiness, pleasure, etc., where does all that register itself? It registers in the psyche. If by any chance we could be totally mindless bodies, insensitive therefore, we would not register any pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow. There'd be no such thing as suffering as we know it. There'd be no problem. But the psyche is there. It is the sensitivity of the whole of the psychophysical organism which is psychologically registers as I like, I do not like, I am happy, I am unhappy, this is painful, this is pleasurable, and so on. And the mistake that all mankind makes is to become attached to what is pleasurable and to want more and more of it beyond the limits of the pleasure that is healthy and helpful both to the body and to the psyche. Therefore, attachment arises. This attachment becomes a fixation, it becomes a craving. And on the other hand, there is the dislike of painful sensations, aversion towards them, aversion towards all the sources of pain, and therefore violence and hate emerges. So we see this complex of attachment, aversion, greed and hate coming into play and bringing about the immature condition of the psyche. This does not mean that life should be a continuous state of what the world commonly understands as self-abnegation, of the suppression of everything in ourself. It does not mean that at all. There is right happiness, true happiness, with which the holy ones were all concerned. Life itself, nature herself, is constantly pouring forth a stream of events, conditions, experiences, which are all happy ones. In the true sense, we do not seek them, we do not desire them, they are just there. Step out of your door into a lovely, brilliantly starlit night, and what an extraordinary feeling suffuses you. The whole of you is happy. You are in the state of true happiness, provided, of course, that your inward poise isn't upset and you go off the deep end and immediately start talking to the person next to you all about the wonderful beauty of the skies and spoiling the silent beauty and marvel of truth. That sort of happiness is constantly being poured into us by the whole of life. And that sort of happiness is a source of power, health to the body and health to the mind, to the psyche. But do not desire it again and again. Otherwise, there is attachment with all its evils. Have you ever considered the meaning of the word desire, derived from desiderare? De, away from, looking away from, siderare is associated with sidus sideris, a star. What is a star? It's a self-shining light, light from within, non-dependent upon anything at all. That's what a star is. And desire means being away from that light, looking away from it. Take the other word, consider. Come together with the self-shining light. So when you consider, you look as attentively as possible, as intensely as possible, into that self-shining light, the light that lights the whole world. You remember yesterday it was mentioned that the world, in the context of religious teachings, essentially, first and foremost, means one's state of consciousness, one's mode of awareness of existence. Because it is according to your state of consciousness, your mode of awareness of the world, that you see or hear or touch the world, the world external to yourself, to your own organism. That is the world. So now, the state of consciousness becomes a matter of great importance. Desire, then, is that which makes you look away from the light. Whereas considering makes you look within and see the light. Now, if one lives the holy life in the true sense, then that light within becomes ever and ever more powerful, brighter and brighter. And as you see more and more clearly, your entire life of thought and feeling, speech and action undergoes a corresponding change. Because thought and feeling, speech and action flow out of your inner mode of awareness, of consciousness itself. You are, none of us, at least I presume, none of us has reached that stage where we are fully awake to our own innermost consciousness. Consciousness is a mystery. That which the Vijnanavadins called Alaya Vijnana, what the Buddha called the Vijnanam Anitasanam Anantam Sabbato Pabam, consciousness, which is characterless, it cannot be characterized, which is endless and therefore beginningless, which is everywhere accessible or shining, according as you use the word pabang or pahang, but both essentially lead to the same thing, which the Upanishadic teachers call Atma. That is what they meant by Atma, that fundamental innermost consciousness, the absolute consciousness. You know how in Zen, for instance, the Buddha is identified with the Absolute, with the All Consciousness. So now, it is in this state where consciousness functions unimpeded by the obstructions presented by our own psychophysical organism, that deathlessness is realized here now. If our consciousness from moment to moment is in complete assonance with the creative pulse of the creative power, the primordial creative energy, if it is in assonance with that, our psychological time is in perfect rhythm with chronological time from moment to moment, which means also that we have come to that stage where we can be wholly aware of the totality. And if and when we are wholly aware of the totality in terms of eternity, we are no longer subject to our limitation of the unidirectional time consciousness. We are limited to that. Therefore, it's the past, the present, the future. But instead of that, in that supreme possibility which the perfected holy ones realized, they are no longer subject to the limitations of the unidirectionality of time, or the limitedness of the moments or hours or even days of the experiencing of timelessness in the supreme meditative state, because that timelessness is bounded by time. It starts, and finally the needs of the physical body impose themselves, and you have to emerge out of that state to the ordinary everyday state. So even timelessness and time are both completely subsumed in that eternity. But that deathless state is the one that is experienced by you, the individual, in the supreme meditative state. The holy ones, the Buddha, like the Buddha, are the givers of deathlessness. So how have they given it? Fundamentally, mainly in terms of that way of everyday life, in thought and feeling, speech and action, which enables the whole of the psyche to become utterly empty of all that acts as a block to the light of transcendence. Our desire, whatever desire we have, good, bad, indifferent, is a block. It is a looking away from the light. It is the introduction of at least a duality, if not a multiplicity. And as long as that duality persists, there is the self separated from the not-self. These are our ordinary human terms. And in that state of separation, the supreme meditative state, in which the consciousness of the absolute all functions freely, is not realized. The body, of course, will, as we ordinarily say, die. Nothing will prevent that. The body is mind, the primordial creative energy, concretized. That which is not concretized remains as pure mind, is what we may call pure mind or spirit. Use any word you like. And we say that the spirit, pure mind, is unborn. If it is unborn, it cannot die. It cannot age, it cannot decay. All this belongs to the realm of the concretest expression of the Absolute. This psychophysical organism. It is this which undergoes change, transformation, and when that transformation is of such a nature that the life continuum ceases in the organism, then that is what we call death. But if one lives the holy life in the true and complete sense of the word, then that supreme consciousness remains all-pervading. Your consciousness will disappear. The infinite expresses us out of itself, and each of us is a finite manifestation of that infinite. Expresses, presses out of. And it presses out of by virtue of self-limitation. I have to use the word self for the infinite, because otherwise I can't say any words at all. Whilst this self is self-conscious and grows to awareness of its relationship with the external world, with other people, and so on, there is the possibility of living in such a manner that the psyche becomes purified, completely empty. Note very carefully the significance and the importance of the Buddha's teaching not to grasp at shape and form, rupa, not to grasp at vedana, feeling, sensation, not to grasp at sanya, thoughts, sankhara, the mental conformations, confections, patterns, whatever you like to call it. Not to grasp at vijnana as such, discriminative consciousness, which is responsible for maintaining the separation between self and not self, as it functions in us as we are. He said, don't grasp at any of these things which constitute the psychophysical being. Now, there is a process which goes on inside our own brains. Each of these elements which compose the psychophysical being is called a skanda, a group, as such. The impressions we receive, which affect the skandas, our impressions through our five physical senses that we know of. And over and above, there is another activity in the brain and through the operation of vijnana, discriminative consciousness, which produces our internal thought and feeling life. In the ordinary way, we say we are thinking, we are daydreaming, or dreaming in our sleep, or we are imagining, or we are planning, and so forth and so forth. This is manovijnana, the sixth class of consciousness. It is associated with manas, mind, which is responsible for making us aware of the continuity of this kind of mental activity. And this is the stream of becoming, which takes place in our own mind. Manas is the link between empirical consciousness, the manovijnana group, and with the alaya vijnana group, the supreme consciousness. So many of you have heard me say, the psychophysical being is transcendence embodied. And this embodiment of transcendence, of the absolute consciousness, which in the Upanishads is openly identified with Atma and Brahman, this manas is the link between the two, the absolute consciousness and the empirical consciousness. And because manas is an emanation, an expression of the absolute consciousness, therefore, in us, transcendence is embodied as a potentiality, a divine potentiality. When we listen, and we do so only extremely rarely, to this embodied transcendence in us, then it changes the course of our whole life, the tenor of our life. We try to listen to it if we are seriously concerned with religious living, but we do not succeed easily or too well. Why? How? We do not really know the art of listening. We do not know the art of looking. What did the Buddha teach in this connection, which he embodied in that wonderful teaching of his, which is called perfect mindfulness, samasati, perfect mindfulness? What did he teach in practical terms? When you see an object, look at it with full attention. And it may be an object, a person, a situation, an event, anything and everything. When you look, when you listen, do so with perfect attention, taking in everything. Do not get entranced by it or by any particular aspect of it, because that will bind you. It will limit your own consciousness inwardly. Realize, keep in mind that this is undergoing continuous change. Now that change can be fortuitous, or it can be regressive, or it can be progressive in the religious sense. If that which animates you is the right impulse, the perfect aspiration from within you, then you will attend in order to understand, not to gain or to lose anything, not to push aside that which is unpleasant or to grasp at that which is pleasant. Look and listen that way, with full attention. When one does look that way with full attention and is well aware of all the reactions from our present conditioned mental state, all of which are registered in the brain, the physical brain, when we look and listen in that way, this tragic separation between self and not self, which is deep-seated within us, no longer functions whilst we are looking or listening that way. Thus, the sense functions become purified, they become pacified, and they become fully active. We don't know at all what real looking means or real listening means. We are in a state of turmoil, of confusion. The disturbed, stormy surface of the ocean. And therefore, the stillness and the perfection of the inner depths are something foreign to us. Look and listen in that way. And then, this separative self-consciousness which arises in terms of mano-vijnana is put to rest. And you are conscious in the true sense. By being conscious in the true sense, one is free of all the conditional evaluations, criteria, and judgment with which we are burdened. Then one is wholly in tune with the rhythm of life itself in its totality. Nothing is missed out. Nothing is ignored. The state of ignorance crumbles, the darkness lifts, and there is light. And that light is fully related to the perfect functioning of all the senses constantly. And therefore, the senses are the true cords of communion between oneself and the whole truth. Now I've put it in a slightly imperfect form by saying communion between oneself and the truth, as if they were two separate things. But having said that first, which most people feel they can understand, let us put it this way. You are in the state of perfect communion, where the separation between self, the existential being who is in this state, and the actual totality, there's no separation. The totality, transcendence itself, the unborn, the unbecome, unmade, is functioning freely through you. And in this is the actualization of deathlessness. But the brain will never know it as such. Because in that state, the whole brain, activity of the brain, is stilled. It's quiet. The senses are utterly pacified. And the whole of the psyche is utterly pure. When the whole of the psyche is utterly pure, mind in itself, that archetypal form through which primordial creative energy acting in eternity functions freely through you. The supremely enlightened state, the state of absolute love, if you like, of peace, the sublime, unoriginated nirvana. That is manifesting itself through you. But you as you, who must of necessity be confined to your organism and to your self-consciousness, will never know it in terms of the empirical organism. Or what we mean by knowing and knowledge is in terms of the limited empirical organism. The thing that is born, grows, and dies. So now, there is immortality, deathlessness realized. There is the perfect enlightenment made manifest, shining invisibly. It's so difficult to use words, because all words belong to the realm of the finite. But if the words, by any chance, happen to produce a thrill, an indescribable, a nondescript, non-describable response from within one's own being, then manas, being in perfect tune, or at least in rhythm with the Supreme Consciousness, is affected for the permanent good, the permanent happiness during your life of what is commonly called oneself. We must appreciate, we must try to appreciate these contexts. The context of limitation and the context of the unlimited and the unconditioned, which wholly contains the context of the limited. Otherwise there'd be no possibility for any such realization. There is a link which that primordial creative energy which functions in innumerable ways, and that energy manifests itself in an extraordinary range, an immeasurable range. In the world of science we know so many frequencies per second and so on. We have a little bit of knowledge filling volumes and volumes of learned works, which are valid for their context and for their purpose. They are all valid. They are not invalidated by truth, the truth, by ultimate reality. Invalidation in the sense of outgrowing that which is imperfect takes place only within the limited context, our own selves, for example. That is all. Now if one really begins to see all that, we become free of looking away from the light. We become free of desire. Good desires as well as bad desires. We become free of the context of ambivalence in which our psyche ordinarily functions. It's important to appreciate this point. And in that freedom, there emerges the reality of nirvana, the deathless state, the non-grasping state, through your own limited living being.